And welcome, folks, to this edition of the Hagman Report. It is Thursday, October 16, 2025. I want to welcome you to this episode. I've got something a little bit different planned for you, okay? You know, in light of everything that's taking place, that has taken place, I mean, the death, the destruction, the very well intentioned, I should say, individuals who are working to get to the bottom of certain things, certain mysteries, you know, I want to kind of lay a foundation of reality. Okay, there's things that we are presented with, you know, on the internet or in digital form. And that's, we work with things, of course, in that venue, but not like many people are. Okay. And the real life, in real life, IRL, is a lot different than a TV show or what other people might attempt to do with respect to internet images and videos and such. And I want to show you the difference. I'm going to lay this out almost like a course in investigations 101, but a little bit more advanced than that, because I know the viewers, the listeners are a lot more advanced. Okay, so but I want to address this, because I had a conversation this week with someone who said, you know, there should be enough evidence. And I mean, name the event where we could actually find the truth. And I said, you know what? In some cases, yes, others, no. And I just want to stress too, because in my experience, while the techniques to address a crime scene or to handle a crime scene, well, the techniques are pretty standardized. The steps that one takes are pretty standardized. No two crime scenes are the same. Okay. You got to treat them differently. Now, having said that as well, you can go down different paths, different roads, different avenues. And I want to bust some myths that'll help everyone. I think this will help everyone. When you're looking at theories or you're looking at videos, you're looking at potential solutions to an event. It doesn't matter what event that is. And I think this will help you discern the truth. Does that sound like a good idea? Folks in the chat, I mean, if you think it sounds good, great. If not, I can certainly move to something else, but, or go beyond that. But I kind of give you some ammunition, or at least some knowledge that you can use to look at something and say, okay, this is how it should be done. For example, what we need to address, solve, and investigate, or whether it's a murder, whether it's whatever crime it might be. This is the proper way to do it. This is what we need to do it, and this is the wrong way to do it. Okay, so does that sound like something you might benefit from, folks? Okay, sounds good. A couple of them, yeah. Good. Okay, go for it. All right, sounds good. Because I want to leave everyone with something perhaps you didn't know, or some upgrade of your existing skills. And I'll say this. The people that I have corresponded with, and a lot of the mail that I receive, okay, and email, but I'm talking about physical mail, people will write notes and such, and I'm going to tell you something, your instincts, your gut, your intuition, your prowess, I'm just amazed, and that's a compliment. Very, very grounded in reality, very grounded and very astute and just a lot of things. So I think this is going to be good. I really do. But that's not all. There are some other things too. But of course, there's always the news of the day and news and more news. I don't think we're ever going to run out of news. And sometimes, you know, when you talk, for example, politics, boy, does that get old sometimes or what? All right. Now, if you're just simply speaking politics and not getting to the root or the ideology that drives certain political agendas and beliefs, then you're not telling the whole story or you're not hearing or seeing the whole story. So I'd like to dig down a little bit deeper on that as well. Now, there's that. And then I want to address something because I want to show you something. I was had the privilege of spending some time with the Shatter Ops group yesterday. Late. Woo. This morning, actually. Anyway, and we were talking about, I had to ask them in person and pretty much individually what they thought. For example, you know, what do you think with respect to the assassination, the murder of Charlie Kirk? And that was one of many things discussed, but that was one thing I thought, well, okay, it's still a very, very charged topic. And I'll tell you what they said. Okay, and I will also tell you or show you something that if you have seen this, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't seen it or seen suggestions of this, then you may be surprised. I'm going to just give you two words, just mull on this for a moment. Snake eyes. How many people know what I'm talking about? And live chat, just go on in and say, yes or no, or what's that? Okay, whatever. It doesn't matter. But yes or no, I'm just curious how many people know Snake Eyes relative to the event of September 10th past. Yep. I guess that's a yep for that, right? Yep. Okay. Yes, the movie. Yes. Well, see what I mean? And I'm not trying to, I'm not blowing smoke up your skirts. Okay. Or whatever, you know, no, this is what I mean about being in the know, knowledgeable, plugged in and astute. I mean, you guys, fantastic. All right. I never saw the movie. Yes, it's a movie from 1998. Nicolas Cage and Gary Sinise. I never saw it. I heard about it relative to this, and I kind of dismissed it. And then we had more of an ethereal discussion or a discussion and beyond anything hardcore evidence. It was just an interesting discussion about certain things about that, and that caused me to look, and this is the other related part of this that caused me to look into what was being said about this on social media. And, you know, of course, Snopes and all of these fact checkers and all of these debunkers, and this wasn't said or that wasn't said. So I started to dig down a little bit, and my goodness, you know what? They're wrong. the date September 10th, this is a big one. The date September 10th did not appear in that movie. What, did you watch it? Because if you did, then I don't know. Would you watch it with, you know, both eyes closed? I mean, seriously. So that brings me to question the agenda, obviously, of those people saying it wasn't there. And if you say it's there, then you're just promoting misinformation. Oh, okay. So then you have to look at whoever's saying that, and you have to look at them and say, wait a second. Yeah, no. And why, when it is clearly there, why are you promoting that misinformation? Okay, so we're going to be getting into all of that. And again, I do have a couple of videos that are instructional videos. Well, instructional / insightful, informative, and the right way things are done. Now, I could have brought our turnout bag, for example, to show you. And I still could, maybe I will, but I mean, what, I'll throw a couple of evidence markers up and some evidence bags, you know, plastic and paper, and the uses of each one, why you use one and not the other in different cases and boxes, and the right way to do things, and then the different various tools. But I thought, are there videos out there that might address some of these things that, you know, are commonly used and necessary to conduct certain investigations? And you go figure. I guess everything's on the internet, right? And we do have like slide presentations and such that things that are taught at both federal and state police academies, and we could show, for example, presentations about different things. But you know what? That would take up too much time, and it's really not necessary. So, all right. All that said, let me back up and just tell you: yes, yes, and yes. John Bolton was in fact indicted today. And again, you think about this, and you think about, wait a second. So he was President Trump's national security advisor for a short period of time, right? Okay. Here we go. You look at the news, you watch the news, you watch MSNBC. No, you don't, but if you did, wow. What a difference from, for example, Real America's Voice. I tune into them all the time. I really don't do much with Fox. But so what's the real information? Well, the real information you have to find from the source. And I know everyone, I'm sure everyone listening and watching this has gone to the source. And then take that source information. For example, how many of you out there have, and you don't need to answer this obviously, but how many of you have gone through the 26-page indictment, okay, and then compared the indictment to what's being reported, you know? And then done the extra step of the research, using the context, the predicate, the context, I'll leave it at that, the context of Bolton's activity relative to the charges. For example, did you know that John Bolton, and this I'm interested in either a Y or an N in the chat. This is kind of important to me. Did you know that Bolton's email, his AOL accounts, where he was sending the sharing classified, oh my goodness, information over an AOL account. Did you know that was hacked by the Nation of Iran? Did you know that? Oh, man. How flippin' bad does it get? Must it get? And of course, Bolton was one of the first, after the Mar-a-Lago raid and the classified documents accusation against President Trump, he was the first one that says, I demand a trial in 30 days and just clear my good name, get the stain off my name, and because if I didn't do anything wrong, well boy, that ship turned around really quick. It's not what he's saying today. Not what he's saying today. So anyway, I want to address that first because that's kind of like the news of the day. Right after this, I want to show you something because in this now, Eric the Tech, this is why we can't have nice things here. Now, Eric the Tech, this is why I always need to have hard copies of my show prep because it takes time to go to the non-hard copy part. Anyway, remember Tuesday's show? Yeah, thank you for tuning in, by the way. Thanks for giving it a thumbs up. Thanks for sharing it, any part of that. And thanks for being there Tuesday. All right. This is kind of the cleanup for the week. So on Tuesday, I spoke of the different groups, the funding sources for what's taking place in the streets of Chicago, Portland. And again, I want to reiterate something I mentioned during yesterday's show, that I really didn't stress hard enough on Tuesday, but I want to stress this very hard today. Okay. I really want to stress this today. And that's the fact that these communist driven, the communist Islamic and transgender groups. Yes. As crazy as it sounds, there's common funding sources for all three. How that works, it's obviously not ideologically driven. It is, with the exception, I mean, the only common factor there is they want to bring down the U.S. from within, okay? Because otherwise, the transgenders out there certainly, or the Muslims certainly don't put up with transgenderism. They tend to throw those people off buildings in the Middle East, you know, the firm believers of that ideology. So how is it that there are sort of common sources of funding and operational support? Well, their goal is, of course, is to destroy everything in the U.S., the violence. And this is really what I want to, everyone listen, I can just, this one statement is the bottom line up front. Violence is about to be unleashed inside the U.S., specifically against soft targets in the suburban areas or the suburban or rural areas. Okay. In the soft targets, I mean the neighborhoods, homes. Yes, homes, schools, mom and pop shops, things like that. And it is being discussed actively on chat groups like Discord and subgroups on, you get the idea. I'm not going to name the locations, but of where the chats exist. Okay, so you have this left-wing / communist anarchist, these groups, not this, these groups, that are pushing all of, pushing this agenda. And they're also tied in with the October 7th group, and the group October 7th, okay, which is a pro-Hamas group, anti-Jew pro-Hamas. Now, to even blow your mind further, or to make your mind kind of, you know, short circuit like it did mine, you have you have intelligence community support, even Mossad support for the pro-Hamas October 7th groups. Now, I'm not saying Jewish support. I'm not saying that. Although I'm sure there is, just like there could very well be Christians supporting Islamic causes. Okay, I'm sure there's that. Well, I know there's that. So, but you cannot necessarily judge, nor should we judge, the Jewish people by the actions of, you know, a few or a limited number of Jews who are activists who are supporting the pro-Hamas agenda, any more than you should judge a Christian or Christians writ large because of a number who are supporting satanic or engaged in satanic kind of crimes and the agenda. So we have to be very careful and also very precise with who we're pointing our fingers at and saying, hey, man, these are the people, right? So then I see a lot, and it hurts me, man. It's hurtful to see a lot of misattribution. Wow. So please, look, understand that we have problems with the nation state of Israel. We absolutely 100%. And, you know, I know Ted Brewer from yesterday, you know, spoke about that, referenced that, and addressed the criticism. You know, show me who I can't criticize, and you get the idea, correct? All right. Well, look, and this goes back to the in real life scenarios of, for example, crime scene investigation, and then the different avenues of investigation in real life. Okay. That's very true. And we're seeing this censorship. We're seeing this, this anti-truth movement because of people trying to say, or people saying, look, you do have people that should be supportive of the Jewish faith involved in pro-Hamas, pro-Muslim activities. It doesn't make sense. But it does when you follow the money, or if you look, for example, at what their core motivation might be. Again, that's just one example. It works on pretty much every religious group, every demographic. So it's not just limited to that. All right. So, and again, this is kind of a cleanup for the week. The reason, and now this is especially true with the Charlie Kirk assassination, with the murder. You know, when he was so effective at changing the minds and the hearts of the younger demographic, especially the young people going to college, right? And he was making a difference. And he gathered a lot of enemies there, a lot of enemies. And people, groups, and even the oligarchs, the elite, the untouchables, the people pulling the strings, they were able to see his effectiveness. Pro-Christian, pro-biblical truths being spoken, anti-LGBTQ stuff, pro-marriage, anti-death cult of, you know, pro-family, anti-death cult. So if you look at the campuses across the United States and really throughout the West as the battlegrounds right now, think of the most important battlegrounds there were in World War II. And you can see, for example, that these are extremely important beachheads, battlegrounds where his words and actions made a difference. So yes, he was cut down in battle, on the battlefield, very important battlefield, and it adversely impacted, of course, the changing of the hearts and minds of the next generation and future generations, to be clear. So that made him a target, and others a target as well. All right, so I say that as well because I mentioned the group Behind Enemy Lines. Behind Enemy Lines, based in Chicago. And you can find out, as a matter of fact, if you follow Stu Smith, and I think his handle is the Stu Studio, or at the Stu Studio, you'll get the song reference, right? On X, he's done a great job, or I think it's he has done a great job in outlining the Behind Enemy Lines. But again, operating in the belly of the beast, which is campuses and inside the U.S., their MO is to destroy, disrupt, cause chaos. And their obvious statements is to resist U.S. imperialism, destroy capitalism, sow the seeds of violence everywhere you go, bring the fight into the U.S., into, and this is important because now we're seeing literature, we're seeing posts, we're seeing discussions, active discussions that we've actually turned over to the federal agencies about violence, about plans of violence. Now, not specific in terms of location, but certainly specific in the intent to create problems in suburbia. They want to move the violence out of the inner city and go to suburbia. Why? Because that will cause trauma to our psyche. And I have to say that the people behind all of this understand certain elements, certain parts of our psyche, of the American psyche. And again, I'm just cleaning up here. The shell groups I referenced on Tuesday, and just basically to touch a couple of them here, that provide funding, for example, and operational support. In no particular order and in no particular, I'm just going to toss out names of the different groups, but we're talking about, for example, financial support groups like National Lawyers Guild. Okay. They provide a lot. Those are the people that you may see in the green ball caps, the neon green, lime green baseball caps out in the streets. Those are people sent by or representing National Lawyers Guild. And in this case, I'm pretty much in agreement with Shakespeare. You know the quote I'm talking about. Okay. Also, Antifa International, yes, that is an organization, a community justice exchange. Boy, doesn't that sound like a fabulous organization? Okay, they're supporting and also providing the financial support to get people, to bail people out of jail, if there's any bail to be had, but primarily in Chicago and some of these blue cities, there's no bail. Just go ahead and leave. See you later. Goodbye. They also funded the George Floyd riots, and that also overlaps and includes the Tides Foundation, goes back to the Soros family. You get the idea. I don't need to pound that home. Again, other groups: Refuse Fascism, Jane's Revenge. Another group that is corresponds with this, you know, the pink hat stuff that happened back in 2017, January. Well, they're part of the group as well, these groups as well. So, and the anti ICE riots right now, the attacks against ICE, a big part of this. A big component, a big supporter, a big organizer is the Party for Socialism and Liberation. And that includes Justice and Education Fund, United Community Fund, People's Forum. And a lot of these are part of the larger part of the, under the umbrella of the, of certain UN related NGOs, if that makes sense, which is hard to make sense of that, but you get the idea there. Lastly, again, to clean this up, the CCP, the Chinese, they have a big presence and a big influence in some of these groups, in some of these areas. The tactics, for example, template for certain tactics is available for everybody to see. It's always you clash with the police, share the resources, whether you are in agreement with the group or not, you share resources. I'm going to give you a name here. Samidoun. Have you heard of that? S-A-M-I-D-O-U-N. They are a terrorist organization. In fact, a designated terrorist organization in Canada. They're associated with or part of or include or encompass the PFLP, which most of us of our age remember or know as the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Big part of all of this, Students for Justice in Palestine college campuses, they're organizing at those particular venues. And that is, those are the groups. That's who's doing some of the major planning, operational support, and also providing financial assistance. And I'll just bring this up one more time. Michael Boyd, I mentioned him, B-O-Y-T. He's a guy that was wearing the Palestinian scarf, which is, when you look at a Palestinian scarf, think of like a Che Guevara sign or like a hammer and sickle lapel pin. Okay. That's kind of that's what they represent. It's all Marxist, it's all communist. And people might say, well, that's, you know, you can't make broad statements like that. And absolutely I can in this case, because his group, for example, and him himself act as a Marxist vanguard for the communist revolution. That's admitted by Michael Boyd himself. All right. So I want to make sure I just covered that. And I didn't cover something I wanted to, and I didn't. And I saw this today. Untitled page, Eric the Tech, untitled page on the show notes, group 764. Folks, have you seen this? You know about this. I think we might have mentioned this before. Hudson Crozier on Twitter or X has brought this out. And I think, in fact, I think one of the shows, I don't know when it was, a few months ago, we spoke about this, but there is a group called 764, and it's a very small organization, but they're involved in satanic worship and satanic activities. Now, I won't get too deep into the activities. If you look into, and this gentleman or this person, this poster did say, I looked into one of their groups on Discord and learned a lot about their strategies to avoid detection and keep finding victims across the internet. Yeah. Well, I can tell you right now that that group no longer, I mean, they were blitzed from the internet. Now, this ideology is really at the core. I've often said that communism was the end game objective here for the globalists and for the takeover of the West. I really was not thinking big enough when I said that, and I have to go back and say no. We have this Satanist agenda, and perfectly outlined this Satanist agenda, which includes really pretty much all races, includes. Well, the common ideology, of course, is worshiping Satan, but they're also they also traffic children. They also have black satanic activities. Now, they don't do this out in the open. They believe, although, by the way, great job on this thread, and you can certainly, I'll put this in the show notes, but they believe their activities in the dark, in darkness, but when I say in the dark, I'm talking about away from the public scrutiny. They believe, for example, if you would drink the blood of a child or sacrifice someone that's look, you don't have to believe it. They don't care what you believe. They believe it. So end the story. But the fact is, they believe that they can get special power. You know, they can get charged up through the blood of the innocent. We've spoke about this before. And that gives them extra energy to go out and to be a part of this revolution, this push, communist push. But in their minds now, groups like this group and groups like them, because there are other sister groups that exist, some better known than others. And I'm not going to name them here. You can do your own research if you wish. But through the trafficking, through the hurting of children, and really the vulnerable, through the drinking of blood, yes, eating the flesh, mock communion. As difficult as this conversation is to have, it's necessary to have this. You've got to understand that we, for example, Catholics or Christians who celebrate services, mass for Catholics, they counterfeit that. Yes, we have a wafer and wine, for example, for communion. They will actually have actual flesh and blood. It's a counterfeit of our services. And again, you may say, well, that's pretty hard to believe, and it doesn't matter. I'm not here to convince you. With everything that Eric the Tech's seen, we've seen the experience of the various groups, again, Shatter Ops, Save Them. It exists, and it is what they do. All right. So a lot of police will not address this. I have not yet, well, one assistant or one DA's office, but sadly only one. Most district attorneys in prosecuting crimes that involve these groups will not address the satanic component of the crime. Why? You can pick a number of different excuses, but they won't address it. But folks, this, again, this is a good time when we're talking about these groups to warn everyone that there is this aspect, there is this element, this demonic, satanic element. And this does, by the way, it does explain the support networks in the trafficking of children across borders internationally. This also does explain the death grip, for example, by Planned Parenthood. Again, in my particular opinion, researched opinion, investigative opinion, Planned Parenthood, why it's so important for them to exist. You remember the Lamborghini woman at Planned Parenthood selling body parts of the murdered unborn children, right? I can tell you this. Not every sale was legitimate. Excuse me. I have a binder of photographs, actual crime scene photographs that I'm really debating on how to present those. Now, I did not take those. This is an assembly of crime scene photographs that were taken, and they were the course material for, again, groups like Shatter Ops and Russ's team and such. But a very important part of that was the acquisition of dead babies, the dead unborn, and not for medical research purposes either. All right. I think I kind of drifted off on the tangent there, but I think it's important for people to really understand how serious this is. Okay. So when you're now to get back to the more topical here, when you are looking, for example, today at the murder of Shirley Kirk, the murder of others who are really doing the job to win hearts, win minds, back to the word of God, back to the principles of the Bible, back to everything that's good, maintaining the sanctity of marriage between a man and a woman. That's the real big part of all of this, and that's what they hate. Before I get into Snake Eyes, I do want to just finish with the also kind of like Steve tonight, right? Just God bless him. By the way, keep me in your prayers. Yeah, he's you know, not feeling well, and it's hard for him to talk without coughing. Well, you saw it before, so just keep me in your prayers. And that's not I didn't mean that in a disparaging way. I'm just, his style sometimes is kind of like a shotgun approach and non-linear. And I tease him about that all the time, and he admits it, and he teases me about stuff. And anyway, but keep me in your prayers. But I wanted to just let you know up front about those groups, kind of clean up with that, and then get into the bulk of what we need to talk about. So, okay, group 764, we're done with that. I mentioned the Bolton indictment. Now, why is this important at this moment in time? Because this 26-page indictment, if you haven't read it, I would urge you to read it. You're looking at charges involving the Espionage Act. You're looking at things done by Bolton. And you might say, well, wait a second, he was on President Trump's cabinet. Well, you couldn't prove that by his actions, because everything he did was against against President Trump. But more importantly, I don't hold President Trump up as a small g god. Okay, I just don't. What I look at is the ostensible intent of what his agenda is, and that is to bring back our America, if that's even possible. So Bolton, after he left the Trump administration, unceremoniously left the Trump administration, you might remember him, pictures of him being in the Nation, or the Nation of Qatar, and what the heck's he doing there? And of course, his book and the excuse, well, he had material that was declassified and authorized for inclusion in his book, and most of this is about sharing information with his editors. No, that's a bunch of BS. Okay, so all of that is important to understand. So I want to show you this. We'll play this. This is cut 4. Out of the various videos that are out there, news reports that are out there, I thought this was the best, most inclusive to explain the nuances of the Bolton indictment. Understand he was indicted by a grand jury, and the fact that this does involve the Espionage Act, 18 counts. I think 8 of those 18 are part of the violations of the Espionage Act, which carry just a tremendously huge penalty. Now, the guy is 76. Is he going to see any prison time? I don't know. But the fact that these charges, the severity of these charges are so significant, this gives me hope that because of their significance, because of the implications of time, I do see the potential here for a grander, for a larger investigation, for additional information, for maybe him giving up some information and names and such. I can see in this case, as well as the other case, most recently, I can see perhaps where we could get to the head of the snake in this respect, or in that respect. And of course, I'm talking about Obama, because Obama, in addition to the domestic terror aspects of what he brought into this country, and by Obama, I'm also including the Biden regime as well, because we know Biden was not in charge of anything. It was really Obama and his handlers. Obama and his handlers, okay? Just understand that. Obama's not the end. He's a middle manager. But so where does Bolton fit into this? This is cut for... This just aired, I think, a few hours ago. And out of all of the videos I saw, I thought this was most inclusive. Here's cut four. And it'll be in the show notes. Also, the link to this will be in the show notes at HagmanPI.com under today's title. You click on that and you'll see all of the links. But here's cut four.
We are well into the season of exposure. I actually like to call it the season of retribution. I am so happy to tell you tonight that the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, has now been charged with 18 counts of sharing thousands of pages of classified information, many of them marked top secret. Who did he share this information to? Two individuals labeled in this indictment, and I have read through the 26-page indictment. These two individuals appear to be his editors. The problem is, in the indictment, it's not that this was for his book. This was information outside of what he published in the book. Very sensitive information. Let me go through some of it. It was intelligence about future attacks. It was foreign adversaries, future missile attacks. All of this compromising national security of the United States of America. There was intel on foreign adversaries in many respects, and it revealed human intelligence operations and sensitive sources and methods. To me, what is spelled out in this indictment, I believe there were people put at risk, Americans put at risk, because John Bolton decided to share this information, maybe for a book, maybe it was his editors. It doesn't matter. Imagine if those editors were compromised. Now, through all of this, in emails to these individuals one and two, he basically acknowledges what he was doing was wrong. This is Attorney Mike Davis.
What's damning for John Bolton in this indictment is they go through in this indictment to show his knowledge and intent. They go through and quote John Bolton in the past for when he's talked about how doing the very things he allegedly did here is a very serious national security crime, espionage. And they go through these documents, and some of these documents are top secret.
So they spell it out, that Bolton was well aware. That's what Mike Davis is saying here, that he was well aware of exactly what he was doing. Now, many of the liberals will go back to President Trump. Oh, this is retribution. Well, it's only retribution. But on top of the retribution, it happens to be a man who, in my opinion, sure looks like he's broken the law according to this indictment. Now, I know from sources very close to President Trump that the only thing President Trump directed the DOJ to do is go after those people who broke the law. Beyond that, the DOJ was completely on its own here. Here's President Trump.
John Bolton was just indicted by a grand jury in Maryland. Do you have a reaction to that?
I didn't know that. You tell me for the first time, but I think he's, you know, a bad person. I think he's a... bad guy, yeah, he's a bad guy. It's too bad, but it's the way it goes.
Well, he was a warmonger, and I believe John Bolton was one of the crew that was there to try to sink President Trump along the way. Now, maybe the most damaging in all of this is that the mainstream liberal corporate media seems to see what I see. That this indictment is most certainly legit. This from CNN.
And that is the sort of thing that the Justice Department does say frequently, not just in the climate of a Trump administration, that that's something that you should not do. We have seen many charges like this before of other high-ranking officials.
All right, so I'm not an attorney, but I can tell you I've read through a lot of indictments. This one's 26 pages long. It seems to use John Bolton's own words against him. Clearly, the DOJ spells out they have the documents that, that show this is classified information being pushed out to someone, to people who shouldn't have it. What's the chance of a conviction? How strong is this case? I want to bring in now 20-year defense attorney Sam Rajofsky is with us. Sam, welcome to the program.
Grant, great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you on, Sam. I imagine you've had a chance to read through this indictment, and I'll just ask you flat out, what's your thoughts on it?
My first impression reading this is it is a very quality a piece of work. I mean, the prosecutors here took time to outline everything that they had, and to the extent that they're obligated to be truthful in their representations to the court, I think this is damning. I think they've got them dead to rights. Going through this, it's a methodical takedown of someone who thought for a long time he was untouchable. He was above the law. He could do things. By the way, Bolton has a history of criticizing Trump and his handling of classified documents. So this to me, I see a conviction happening here. If these facts are as alleged and they're able to demonstrate so in court, Bolton's in real trouble.
You know, okay, one of the things that prosecutors did.
Folks, that goes on for another 4 or 5 minutes, but there you have a good outline and a good outlook of what is taking place. Now, I was watching the chat during that period when the video was playing. And again, Hagmann Report on Rumble. That's our home. We'll never go back to YouTube. Please click follow follow. And if you think we deserve it, give us a thumbs up, and most certainly comment. Put your comment down there. However, please be nice and respectful. Don't make fun of somebody. Don't threaten anyone. You know the routine, right? All right. So when I was watching the chat, Vibe One, absolutely. Todd Blanche, being the deputy attorney general in the Bondi attorney, AG. Yeah, that's a problem, right? We know that. I don't know who is doing this, the selections. I don't know what's going on, but that's a problem. I agree with you. And look, I do know, look, the Adelson's influence, obviously there's Jewish influence, but at what point do we have to, I mean, we certainly can ascribe some guilt or guilty behavior to people like that, okay? But at what point do we say, wait a second, this goes far beyond whether someone is a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim? I mean, a crime is a crime is a crime, right? That's not to say there's undue influence. I'm not saying that at all. I would feel best if we made sure that there was no outside influence by any, by APEC or APEC or whatever. In other words, everyone who was elected into a position or even appointed into a position of power in our country, was their only allegiance is to the U.S. Okay, I truly believe that. So again, I recognize things like that. Look, I don't know who did write that, but I recognize that. But again, And I'm not excusing it. I'm just saying it's not only that. There's more than just that. Okay. So, and also, Peter Skull 67, is everyone compromised in our government? You know, I'm beginning to think that pretty much everyone is. And I think it's by different, there's different ways to become compromised. And I think pretty much everyone is at some level. At some point, maybe you might have a handful that are not, and you may, and perhaps this is correct, say, well, you're painting with a broad brush, but I'm not talking about specific faiths or anything like that. I'm talking about activities that can be proved. And I do believe that I think we have a big problem with foreign influence, with moral corruption, with personal corruption inside our own institutes of power, institutions of power. So thank you for all of those comments. Look, they're not false. I'm just saying that there's more than just that, if that makes any sense. Okay. So the Bolton indictment, big news. And I do believe that that will lead to additional actors, additional suspects being indicted from that indictment. But that was and if you read it, it's a really kind of a masterpiece, in my opinion, it's the best indictment I've seen. It's all encompassing. It's very, very well done. Again, I'm not an attorney, but like Grant, he said, I'm not an attorney. Well, yeah, you don't have to be to recognize the fact that this was really well done. Okay, so there's that. And I have links, and I'm like, we don't have to put them up. I do have links to the actual indictment from Court Listener. There's also a great New York Post piece on the indictment. We don't have to play that, but they'll all be included in the show notes. Okay. All right. Now, so that's kind of like the news of the day, right? Now, let me go on to another bit of news that's really not getting a lot of the traction. I'm just getting some traction, but not the traction it needs. And I think about this because the travesty, the horrors done to the patriots that went to the Capitol on January 6th and were imprisoned. It's a horrible, horrible thing. People were bankrupted. How many of those individuals were veterans with PTSD? How many of those individuals had their lives ruined by simply walking between the velvet ropes? And there must be accountability for the persecution of this. That was a political persecution. So I found this next video, and we showed this video last night, just a 20-second part of the very first part of this video. What about that group of people? And I do know in the chat, and I want to say this, it's not related to J6, but I know there are people in the chat that have been traumatized. They're victims of trauma, childhood trauma by some of the most horrific things any human can do to another human. All right. I'm not going to name, look, I know who you are, and my heart hurts, and I pray for you, because the damage caused by what you went through, you cannot just possibly describe that to anyone who has not seen or understands the depravity of the individuals causing that trauma. And I have to recognize, again, shatterops.org, the men and women there, as well as Save Them. Not only do they bring children and the vulnerable and women out of bad situations, but there's also the restoration component. There's also the healing process, which they attempt to provide. And you know, their resources are very thin. But the fact is, we have to recognize that when we talk about like the Epstein files or the actions of Epstein's, the trafficking, yeah, you've got big problems there. But what we also have to keep in mind, the victims, the child victims, the trauma, the damage, let's not forget them. Okay. Just want to say that. But back to January 6th. Alison Steinberg, this is video 6 in the show notes, asked Pelosi about the first J6 committee. And we all know what a sham that was, right? Well, this is the war room, Steve Bannon, starting out with that video, but also talking about the new committee to investigate what happened on January 6th and to investigate the original committee and the establishment thereof. This is important. And folks, I do believe you're going to see this gain a lot of momentum. And I do hope, based on everything that I was told, not hopium hope, but again, a seasoned and reasoned perspective of hope, that we will see people being called to account for their actions against the patriots, for their actions against people exercising their rights to say, wait a second, this election, it was a sham. Now, I understand Tina Peters, of course, is still in prison. That is a horrific, an intolerable situation that needs to be corrected right away. So there's that. You may say, well, we're not seeing much on that. I know that we've been pushing for that to be rectified. Others have been pushing for that to be rectified with this administration. I don't know what the holdup is, but we're doing everything we can, possibly can. But back to J6. And we'll just hit the J6 or hit video 6 about J6. Here it is.
Congresswoman Pelosi, are you at all concerned that the new January 6th committee will find you liable for that day? Are you at all concerned about the new January 6th committee finding you liable for that day? Why did you refuse the National Guard on January 6th?
Shut up. I did not refuse the National Guard. The president didn't send it. Why are you coming here with Republican talking points as if you're a serious journalist?
The American people want to know. We still have questions. Thank you.
That's actually Nancy Pelosi had the question.
The American people want to know what the American people know.
We want to know
the American people know that, what the American people want to know, why so many people are too stupid to know the truth. That's what the American people want to know. Like, they're fed disinformation by Lindell Network and by all these other right wing networks.
Media.
Like this lie, like that it
Pillow
was
media.
Nancy said January 6th, Nancy Pelosi refused. No, that's a lie. But it's amazing, Mika, how these lies become truth. In part, they become truth because more Democrats don't do what Nancy Pelosi just did right there. The lies are everywhere on the far right, and they're all around January 6th. The lies continue. They try to do investigations where there are lies. We're going to see the president talking about investigating the investigators again after they spent years with John Durham doing the same thing, spending millions and millions of taxpayers, again, pursuing lies. And yet, this is the American people. No, the American people know there are a group of people who intentionally want to believe lies on the MAGA right. It, you know, it's like Jesus said, you know, there are people who like could go into the light, but they choose the darkness instead. That's a spiritual side. We're talking politics here. Far less significant, of course. But people can know the truth, but they don't like the truth. So they keep spouting lies to Nancy Pelosi and other people about January 6th when they know the truth. They've even tried to erase that attempt to throw out a presidential election from their minds. Mm-hmm. And now they want to go on, and now they want to prosecute other people who they think, oh, Joe Biden sicked on Donald Trump. My God, could you imagine what Lindell TV. Well, can you imagine what the far right, what the MAGA right would have done if Joe Biden had held a press conference in the Oval Office saying, I want these four or five, you know, Republicans arrested? They would have gone crazy. And the question is, when are Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee going to say something? When are the Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee going to say something? When are the far right wing podcasters going to say something, saying, you know, this is really dangerous because they're going to come after us next?
Yeah.
If this is the new normal in Washington, D.C., we might be next. No, no, no. This has to stop. And here is a president. I've said it before. I'll say it again. Here is a president that had a historic breakthrough in Middle East peace. And 2 days later, he's just completely stepping on every good headline by talking about continuing to pursue political enemies. It makes no political sense for him. It's bad for Republicans. It's bad for Democrats. It's bad for everybody. And yet it continues. Republicans need to speak up. And for God's sake, when is the United States Supreme Court going to stop all the ambiguity so Americans can stop being like thrown to the ground and beaten up and arrested, only to be released later on?
Mm-hmm.
By law enforcement officials, like going after illegal immigrants? Like, when it, like, the pace is quickening, and it's quickening every day. And if Republicans don't speak out, and if the Supreme,
folks, I apologize. I did not realize that I included that section, that cold open. But it gives, I think that gives people a window into what others are watching, what others are hearing. And that's part of the behavioral modification or indoctrination process that many of your neighbors are getting. Many people that you might, maybe family members are listening to. It is that and that type of indoctrination that is forming the minds, modifying the behavior of many people out there. Now, because in the interest of time, I won't continue that. Okay. You can watch the response by Steve Bannon and watch the entire video clip. I didn't want to end it on that note, but I thought it was important to show this clip. But enough said. I didn't account for that extended cold open. And I do want to add into this. When you look at those two faces on the screen, when you look at Mika Brzezinski and her husband, okay, think about this. Joe Scarborough, but think about this. Think about, you go back to July 20th of 2001. In addition to Brzezinski being a globalist, father, of course, was a big globalist proponent of the what we call today this New World Order. Think about where Scarborough came from, and think about how compromised, again, hat tipping to the people in the chat, understanding where these people come from. July 20th, 2001, there was, at that time, Scarborough was a U.S. rep out of Florida, representative out of Florida, and a constituent service coordinator for Scarborough, a Republican, no less, in Florida at that time, found the body of Lori Klozutis. She's 28, found her body in Scarborough's office, dead, of course. The long and short of that was, well, she died because of a previous unknown health issue. She hit her head, and she died because of that injury. Okay. She suffered a medical event, hit her head, bashed her skull in, lay dead for a while, found only by people coming back into the office in this warm summer day in 2001. Why do I bring this up? Because when you go back and look at the components, the evidence that was presented at the time, man, you had pretty much every, if you take the template of the people, the same people involved in forming a or contaminating a crime scene, or forming an improper conclusion or a non-investigation into a suspicious death, nothing's changed in the past 24 years. Nothing has changed. The same positions are used to form to stop, for example, the truth from coming out. The various positions, whether it's a medical examiner / coroner, doing some hanky panky stuff, perhaps, maybe. The police failing to classify or investigate the discovery of the body, failing to investigate it as a suspicious death, saying, okay, yeah, you're right, it was just something that happened. Yeah, boy, wasn't that just, you know, well, I'll tell you what. You look at Scarborough's trajectory since then, and look at where he was then and where he is now, and what's changed. Well, if you go back to that period of time, there were people talking, saying, you know what? Scarborough cannot enter the primary race for the position he was going after at the time because he's compromised. He can't afford for anyone to be asking questions to probe the death of that intern. The same thing that happened back then is happening today. There's probably not a week that goes by, or even perhaps a day that goes by, that there's an element of compromise by our elected officials, by our appointed officials. Think of the bloat that we have in government, the size of government. This is pretty much the same. The same things are happening today. All right. Now, and again, you're looking at questioning a narrative. The narrative, of course, at that time is the death. Well, it happened the way we said it happened. The question is, did it happen, really happen that way? The likely answer is no. Now, getting back into what I mentioned at the beginning. So can we, for example, address some of these things? Yes, we can, but let's do it properly. For example, the horrific murder of Charlie Kirk. Can we say, wait, there's something really wrong here? So what's in real life, which we have to associate, or we have to disassociate ourselves from a lot of these theories that just, I'm not going to say are out there, but way out there. I mean, totally out there. But yeah, I guess I am saying that some are. But then there are some things I can't explain. So before I show you the in real life scenarios, how to look at different things and make your own assessments from the knowledge, which I'll show you, I want to show you this, which I can't explain. I can't explain. This Eric the Tech. This is an attachment I sent, and this is about Snake Eyes, which I mentioned earlier or at the top of the show. If you want to put that up when you can, I can't explain this. Snake Eyes, of course, was a movie starring Nicolas Cage and Gary Sinise back in 1998. And the Snake Eyes movie featured a victim, U.S. Secretary of Defense Charlie Kirkland. Charlie Kirkland was the victim. He was fatally shot in the neck during a live event, as was Charlie Kirk. There were extreme similarities there. The assassination of this fictitious Charlie Kirkland did happen on September 10th. Regardless of what Snopes might say or whatever else, what they might, yes, it did. Because on the marquee, in the venue which they were at, it was a fight venue, a boxing venue, a boxing event. It was September 10th. And pay very close attention to the marquee for other reasons. I would add, or they add, the public speaking events at the university with a large audience, the configuration could be very similar to the configuration of the Kirkland or the Snake Eyes movie, the venue, the boxing venue. Again, moving on with some odd things. And I'm not, all I'm saying is I have nothing, folks. I don't know. I can't explain this. I really can't, nor do I really want to try. I'll just tell you, talk amongst yourselves. I mean, I don't know. In the movie, Lincoln Tyler was one of the boxers. In order for this event, this fatal shot to be taken, he had to take a dive. He was actually framed as the accomplice in the movie. Tyler, his name was Lincoln Tyler. Then we have the suspect in Charlie Kirk, Tyler Robinson. The what they name is in this chart, what's named as conspiracy elements. If you look at the Charlie Kirk assassination, ongoing investigations suggest possible inside job or broader motives, which do exist. I mean, I would not label those as conspiracy elements. And then, of course, for the movie, you can read that yourself. There are other elements of a conspiracy there. And there was also a connection to President Trump in terms of the movie, the scenes. Some of the scenes were filmed at the Trump Taj Mahal, the casino in Atlantic City. And of course, Charlie Kirk was a dear friend, close friend of President Trump. And lastly, the eyewitness videos for the Charlie Kirk assassination and live coverage led to debates over what really happened. That's a key thing right there, as is the next thing, the corresponding aspect to the movie, the tagline, "Believe everything except your eyes." And of course, what does that mean? That emphasizes the deception, the unreliable visuals. And that's what I've been talking about for so long. But in the entirety of this movie, Snake Eyes 2, that the similarities, much like the other TV programs, Simpsons and other such programs, look, I can't explain that. I cannot explain it. I'm noting it here. This, I'm presenting it here. Think of this, handle this as you will. Okay. Eric the Tech, did you know that? I'm just curious. Were you aware of that? You can say. Okay. All right. Yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting. Okay. So. I'd like to go to video B in the show notes, because we can talk, and to me, this is extremely critical when we talk about handling certain, when you and I look from the perspective of our computer screens or TVs, we're looking at two-dimensional images, we're looking at certain things, and we're asking questions, which are some are great questions, why certain things are done or aren't done that should have been done. So again, I was going to bring out our own turnout bags to show you the proper way things should be done. And I thought, well, maybe we can make a video, you know, short video. And then I thought, well, maybe there's a video that exists. And I looked at a bunch of them. The shortest one I could find is this one. And this is an introduction to crime scene. So I included it here with the intent to increase all of our knowledge bases. Okay. All of the, in other words, to me, this is what people, this is a proper way, for example, of how to handle a crime scene. The video itself, not perfect, not all inclusive, but touches on a lot of good things, a lot of things that we all have to keep in mind anytime we're looking at an event. If you're looking for a solid baseline, a solid metric from which to operate, this will help you. Okay. So that's why I selected this. And that's why I want to include it here, because we all have questions, and we could take it as recently as, again, last September 10th, all the way back to, you know, July 13th of 2024 in Butler. And even before that, of course, we can go back as far as Kennedy and again, even before that. So, but look at this and consider when you're looking at the information, the various theories on the internet, keep this in the back of your mind. This and one more video I'm going to show you, but this is only about 4 minutes. I'm going to let this play through, because this is important. It gives you, again, it establishes a baseline, and it's important for people to understand. And hopefully you'll benefit by this video. Here it is.
From the second a crime is committed, traces of the crime are left in the environment. The location where a crime took place can be full of physical evidence, which can link the crime to the criminal and ultimately assist the police in their investigation. This location is known as the crime scene. Crime scenes can be anywhere, indoors, outdoors, at business premises, domestic dwellings, or vehicles, and no two are ever the same.
The work of a crime scene investigator, or CSI, is a key part of processing a crime and obtaining evidence. For this reason alone, the skills they need and the procedures they follow are of vital importance. Before a CSI even enters the crime scene, they need a full set of appropriate protective clothing. The full crime scene suit, sometimes called a bunny suit, consists of boot covers, gloves, a hood, and a mouth guard. This clothing will protect the CSI and ensure they do not contaminate the crime scene.
Can you put me up there and pause that for a second? I mean, put me next to it or whatever. That bunny suit, I don't know how many people out there have worn those Tyvek bunny suits with the booties. I'm going to tell you what, very, very uncomfortable, very not comfortable, and they're a little bit bulky, clumsy in my view, but necessary, because there is transfer of skin cells, DNA, whatever, shoe prints, footprints. So this is quite necessary to have when it's required. Now, from TV shows, you know, I'd say from the 70s or 80s, you're not going to see this. But now that we've graduated into the age of DNA, the age of touch DNA and transfer and such, this is important to have. So consider this too, when you're looking at events taking place in real time, or even videos of events, and look at the responders, and you'll be able to tell you'll be able to tell who the crime scene, the forensic people are versus the first responsive or responding team of law enforcement officers. Why is that important? For identification purposes. And one thing that's not mentioned in this video, I don't believe, is each crime scene, if they haven't set up a perimeter, they need to. And if I don't believe they mentioned this either, at every crime scene there is a person in charge of logging people in and out. So in other words, think of somebody like, think of a bouncer at a nightclub, okay, or somebody at a nightclub with a list. You're not on the list. Well, when people arrive, they sign in, okay, or they're signed in, and you have to account for every person that responds to that crime scene. So again, that's the only somewhat deficient part I saw of this video, but continue, please. Go ahead.
Crime scenes often occur outside, and a police officer is usually the first person at the scene. However, the police officer should not disturb the crime scene and should instead set up a cordon to protect the evidence contained within. When the crime scene investigator enters the crime scene, they will use the common approach path. This is the path from the edge of the cordon to the focal point of the crime scene, and in most cases, stepping plates will be used along this path to preserve the evidence. When available, these stepping plates should be used at all times. A CSI's job is to both accurately document and process the crime scene. Documenting the scene involves taking photographs of the crime scene, of exhibits, and taking notes. Documenting the crime scene will continue as they start to collect the evidence. As the crime scene is processed, the CSI has to be very conscious of environmental factors which may compromise the evidence. This is especially important in outside crime scenes, as factors such as rain, snow, and strong wind can mean the need to collect the evidence faster than normal or erect temporary structures to protect the evidence. The crime scene may also need to be protected if it's near a public area where the media or passers-by can see it. Time of day can also play a major role in how a crime scene is processed. In some instances, it may be advisable to preserve the scene until natural light is available. However, in many cases, temporary, high-powered lighting rigs and powerful torches can be used to process the scene. Indoor crime scenes have their own set of issues, whether it's a business property or a domestic dwelling. In indoor crime scenes such as burglary, the CSI may have to speak to a victim of crime. In such cases, they should be empathetic and have good communication skills. They must also be considerate of personal environments and balance the respect for someone's property with the need for a thorough scientific examination. In more serious crimes, it may be necessary for the CSI to remove objects and furnishings from the property. Another common crime scene is vehicle crime. These are processed like any other crime scene. However, in less serious crimes, such as car theft, the CSI will focus their efforts on the point of entry, such as a broken window. In more serious crimes, the car can be fully stripped to look for evidence. This would include lifting the carpets, taping the upholstery, and analysing the lifts for trace forensic evidence.
As you can see, crime scenes are very varied and take place in a wide range of locations. However, they do have a number of basic principles in common, including cordons, common approach paths, and the systematic recovery and collection of evidence. The crime scene investigator has a key role in documenting the crime scene and collecting the physical evidence left during a crime.
Okay, so there's that. That's the most basic of the most basic introductions into the crime scene. So how do we apply that today to what we see in real life events taking place? Can we evaluate, for example, the response of certain crimes that we see? For example, the assassination of Charlie Kirk. Can we apply what we saw there to what happened? What we know or can establish that happened in response to the murder of Charlie Kirk? Or let's take it one step back in time. How about the Butler murder? Don't forget, there was a homicide that was committed in Butler. Anything in that video, does anything in that video tell you that, for example, the Butler case was not handled pursuant to the most basic of the basic generally accepted investigative not techniques, but rules? The most basic handling a crime scene. Obviously not. No, it wasn't. When you have an FBI agent washing off the roof, no, that no, not even close. So that, do you see where I'm going with this? That gives, and maybe 99% of you watching and viewing this, or watching this and listening to this, maybe you already knew that. Okay, well, let's get into one more thing here, a little bit deeper. And I'm watching the time here, but let's go just one step deeper. Now, when I first saw this video, I looked at it and I'm thinking, is it necessary? And then I thought, as I watched it again a second time, I thought, you know, there's some good points here that involve photography. It involves the visual aspects of crime scene investigation. And it also gives you an idea, too, of some of the limitations that we have, or that the agencies have today, despite what you might see on television. So I thought this one was a great compliment to the first one. Are you guys in chat? You okay with me doing this? Okay. All right. Here's a video. What is it, video A? Now, this is a little bit longer. This is about forensics and the crime scene. And I do believe this will address some of the issues with Butler and with the murder of Charlie Kirk. It'll help all of us to kind of make sure we're like focused on real life aspects of the issue, and we don't get lost in things that we cannot possibly prove, or we're things that we're using that we shouldn't be using in terms of standards of evidence. But here is cut A. Go ahead.
Let's talk about crime shows. In a nonstop media stream filled with reality shows, cooking competitions, and whatever's happening in Westeros, police procedurals are probably as close as most of us are going to get to seeing science portrayed in primetime. And the techniques that crime fighters use to catch bad guys vary from show to show, but a lot of the time it involves forensics, which is basically the use of science in the field of law, in this case, criminal law. Different kinds of forensic investigators have different roles, like analyzing crime scenes or running tests in the lab, and they can specialize beyond that, focusing on analyzing DNA or bullets, for example. Generally, they all have an undergraduate degree in a scientific field, like chemistry or biology, or a more targeted degree in forensic science itself. Some have a graduate degree, too, and medical examiners, or MEs, usually have a degree in medicine. But they all have one thing in common, using science to find, gather, and analyze evidence that can be used in court. However,
Eric, can you pause that for a second?
That real...
Okay, so I saw a comment in chat when I said, hey, is this okay to do? You do you, and thank you before that. Yeah, I am going to do me. And speaking of that, you do you, there's a distinction, because we've had people, and I've seen discussions, Chris Martinson and others talking about ballistics, Sam Andrews talking about ballistics. That is a special forensic discipline. I don't do ballistics. I do my area of forensic interest and training is blood spatter analysis. No L. Okay, it's blood spatter analysis, which is wow. Okay. But I look at ballistics and I say, wow, too, because it's very precise. It's a very precise discipline. And it requires very precise training. So if you ever see me discussing ballistics on the internet or on a show or something like that, man, I am out of my lane, okay? And I wouldn't expect someone who's in ballistics to talk about blood spatter, because they're two different disciplines, but that's important for everyone to know. Because there will be people who will get out of their lane for clicks and then totally screw it up. Because I certainly would screw up ballistics. No, believe me, I would. So, okay, go ahead and continue with this.
Science doesn't always make for entertaining TV, so writers tend to take some liberties with how forensics really works. Most of the time, they aren't completely off the mark. For example, the tests they use on the show might actually exist, but they wouldn't be nearly as fast or accurate in real life. And the technology they use is just ridiculous. We're here to clear that up and talk about what forensics can actually do, which turns out to be pretty interesting all by itself. And to do that, we're going to solve a hypothetical crime. So here's our case. Someone finds a dead guy in an alley in Chicago. The cops secure the scene, and the forensic investigators show up around 11 p.m. to gather clues. When they go through the victim's pockets, they find a receipt for a bottle of soda from a nearby convenience store time-stamped at 5 p.m., 6 hours earlier. And, according to the ID in his wallet, his name is Bob. The medical examiners want to know how long Bob has been dead, which could be key to finding and catching his killer. So there are a few things they can check, and they all happen to end in the word mortis, which makes sense, because that just means death in Latin. First, there's livor mortis, or how the blood pools. Now that Bob's heart isn't distributing his blood anymore, it just goes where gravity takes it, and that makes the skin look purplish from the outside. But if a body's been dead for more than 12 hours, the blood will have coagulated or dried. It stays in place, and if you shift the body, the blood won't pool in a new spot. Now, Bob's blood seems to still be very liquid, so he's been dead less than 12 hours, though of course the examiners already knew that, since he was alive and well in the convenience store only 6 hours ago. Next, they check if rigor mortis, the stiffening of the muscles after death, has set in. And rigor mortis is proof that your muscles work in kind of the opposite way than you might expect. Since running and lifting weights and doing things that require muscles is hard, you might think making your muscles contract requires a lot of energy. But that's not true. Your body actually uses energy to make your muscles relax, not contract. So after someone dies and their muscles stop getting chemical energy, their muscles can't uncontract, so their bodies stiffen. This effect starts about 2 hours after death and lasts until about 36 hours in, when the muscles decompose enough that they can't hold their position anymore. In Bob's case, rigor mortis does seem to have set in. He's frozen in place, so the body's probably more than 2 hours old. They'd like to get a more accurate number, though. If the body is close to 6 hours old, that means he was probably murdered right after he left the store. So they take the body's temperature, rectally, a detail they don't normally show in crime dramas, and it's 29 degrees Celsius. Now, normally, a body loses heat at a rate of about 1.5 degrees Celsius per hour, a process known as algor mortis. When Bob was alive, his body temperature would have been 37 degrees, so it's lost 8 degrees so far. You'd think Bob's been dead for very close to 6 hours. And in a TV show, the Emmy would probably say that. But there's a problem. This is a cold winter evening in Chicago, and it's about 5 degrees outside. The body's going to lose heat a lot faster to the colder air, but it's hard to tell exactly how fast. Given all the information they've gathered, our Emmys put the time of death between 5 p.m. and 7 p.m. There's no way to tell if Bob was murdered right after he left the store or 2 hours later. So, detectives head to the store and ask to review the security camera footage, hoping they'll be able to figure out if anyone was with Bob when he bought his drink. Turns out that as Bob left the store, the camera picked up someone quickly emerging behind a nearby tree to follow him down the street. But it was so far away that the stalker's face is all pixelated and blurry. You can hardly even tell it's a face, let alone whose it is. Now, if this were a TV show, usually the detectives would zoom in on the face and enhance the image somehow, and then run the magically clear photo through a facial recognition database. And then maybe the next part of the story is that they get a match, which leads them to another clue. But in real life, there's no way they could enhance a picture like that. When a camera captures a digital image, it's recorded as data that forms a map of the colors in each point or pixel in the picture. And those pixels cover bigger or smaller amounts of space depending on the resolution or how many pixels there are in that image. The color of each pixel is recorded as the average of all the colors within that space. But once the color is stored as the average, that's it. You can't enhance the resolution of a photo because there's no way to tell which amounts of which colors went into that average in each pixel. Like, let's say your camera has 8 megapixels, which is pretty typical for a smartphone. That means it takes a picture with 8 million pixels in it. That sounds like a lot, but let's just say you want to take a picture of something really small or really far away, like a person at the other end of a field. You can zoom in a lot, but you still probably won't be able to make out much detail. Whatever's written on their t-shirt, for example, might just look like a few blocky dark green squares. And there's no way you can enhance those squares to see that the dark green pixels are just averaging together the bright green letters on a black background that spell out SciShow, which of course are available at dftba.com/SciShow. If you wanted to be able to make out what's on the shirt, you need a lot more pixels that would each depict a smaller area of that mysterious figure. But let's say our real-life detectives look through some more of the footage and realize the person who was following our victim was actually back in the store about 3 hours later. They can tell because he was wearing the same clothes. The camera captures him as he puts something down on a shelf, then leaves. They get a close-up picture of his face and run it through the database. Facial recognition actually has a long history because it's one of those things that humans tend to be very good at, but it's hard to get computers to do well. Humans are excellent at finding patterns, but the computers have to be taught what to look for. Human features, it turns out, are arranged in very specific ways, but the specifics are unique to each person. For example, everyone has a certain curvature to their eye sockets or distance between their nose and mouth. Those dimensions are different for everyone, but computers can be programmed to measure them and then use the data to identify faces. Together, these metrics make up a face print, and there are actually databases of face prints compiled from things like mugshots. A computer can take an image of a face, like the one of the man following Bob, and compare his face print to ones already in the database. On TV shows, that database will usually be shown as a sophisticated system with all the data in one place. All the detectives have to do is type some commands on a keyboard, and the computer starts cross-referencing with every picture ever taken in the country. But that kind of law enforcement database doesn't really exist, at least not yet. The FBI is working on what they say will be the world's biggest database of biometrics, with tens of millions of records. But for now, if cities have searchable face print databases at all, they're usually local. Chicago, for example, has one called NeoFace that looks for matches in the police photo database. In our case, the investigators catch a lucky break. When they run the suspect's face print against the Chicago Police Department's database of mugshots, they find a match. His name is Charlie, and he owns a hardware store a few blocks away. When the investigators inspect the shelf that they saw him putting something on, they find a wrench with a dark red stain. Thinking that it might be their murder weapon, they take a swab of whatever's on the wrench, then do something called a Castle-Meier test to see if it's blood. On TV, you might just see them spraying some liquid onto the swab to see if it changes color, but in real life, they'll need to use two different substances. First, they add the chemical phenolphthalein to the swab, then a couple of drops of hydrogen peroxide. If there's blood in the sample, the two compounds will react with each other, turning the phenolphthalein a vivid shade of pink. Blood contains hemoglobin, which acts as a catalyst, basically the substance that makes a reaction happen. With hemoglobin's help, the peroxide reacts with the hydrogen in phenolphthalein and becomes water. The new hydrogenless form of phenolphthalein then turns pink. If there were no blood on the wrench, the reaction wouldn't happen because it wouldn't have a catalyst to help it along. But in this case, the swab from the wrench does turn pink, meaning that the stain is probably blood, so the investigators take the wrench for further testing. Back at the lab, okay, they run a DNA analysis on the blood.
And the rest goes into the DNA analysis and such. Okay, so what can we take away from this video? And yeah, the guy's hair, not my style, but again, the message here is accurate, 100% accurate. There's two areas that I was concerned with that I think apply to, especially with the latest stuff about the murder of Charlie Kirk. Two specific areas here, to me, extremely important. The first part that we saw was the camera, the frame, the enhancement of the video. I see people attempting to enhance videos using certain software they may have on their computers, and it just doesn't work well, okay? Because you have to have a quality image to begin with. And a lot of videos, especially security videos, are already affixed at a specific frame rate. And I'm using my terms, okay? The quality is already maxed out for that device. So when you try to create this, or when you try to enhance an image, you're not going to get an accurate representation. So when you start off with a limited sample or the limited original frame or video, you are kind of stuck with the resolution offered by that device. Does that make sense? I hope it does. So a lot of things have limits right now, and especially when people attempt to use footage, whether it's, well, in this case, like I said, the homicide of Charlie Kirk, things go not as one would expect them to go, especially if you watch television programs like CSI and such. Okay, it just doesn't work that way. The second part, Castle-Meier test. Well, I'll tell you what, we can end it there rather than getting into the weeds. And you can watch that and apply it to what you see on the internet with, again, well-intentioned people, many with knowledge about this, analyzing certain pieces of footage. And in some cases, not being able to get it right, not being able to get it right because we're the sample image or the image being used itself has limitations. And then, of course, to think that you can match it as quickly to a certain person. And there are programs out there that you can use for facial recognition. I've seen some of them available. They're not the greatest. So you might come out with a false positive, all right? So that's important for people to understand, or no match at all, equally bad. So recognize those when you look at someone else's analysis. Very important, in my view, to understand the limitations of the product that you're using to make your case. It's difficult sometimes, if not impossible sometimes, to do so using what is provided to you. And that also brings up questions with respect to, for example, the FBI videos of the so-called or alleged pipe bomber. Why? And this is a legitimate question. Why, for example, did the FBI, and we know this to be true, downgrade the frame rate of the videos of the FBI bomber? Now you have, at least in my view, based on what you know, what's been offered here, you know that there's some hanky-panky going on or had gone on with respect to the offering of that video. They didn't want you to identify that person. And then the question becomes, why not? All right. So you see where I'm coming from. All right. And again, none of this is meant to take away from the intent of those trying to solve or trying to get to the bottom, get to the truth of the matter. We just have to know our limitations. And that includes me too. Includes all of us. So that brings me to this. And again, this is strictly about the Charlie Kirk homicide. There's an account on X, and it's called Paramount Tactical. Now, if you go to Eric the Tech, if you go to, they've done. But by the way, Gary Melton has done a tremendous job. If you've never heard of Paramount Tactical, Gary Melton, you can. The link will be in the program description at HagmanPI.com. The link to their X account. And they've done a tremendous job. He's done a tremendous job in the investigation of the scene, the analysis of whether it's ballistics or the mapping out of the site. The latter, of course, is looking at the site and mapping it out. Now, why is this important? Because he spent his own money to go out and to have a professional drone operator that maps out sites for construction purposes to map out the entirety of the UVU campus. And if you go to that link, it's should be in the show notes. It would be, well, actually, video one. Let's go to that, and he'll explain this current issue. That the video that we, the videos, once one video in particular that's making its rounds on the internet was AI created or AI influenced. Wow. When you toss in the AI component today, man, that's a whole new set of problems we have, right? And can we trust our eyes? Going back to the opening of the show. Or near the opening of the show. What was that about snake eyes? Hang on. Let me bring that back up here. Believe everything except your eyes. That was in 1998. How true is that today? Especially today with the AI influence. So Paramount Tactical had taken on, and I should add this, taken on some heat. And coincidentally, or not so coincidentally, got some heat, some threats, some harassment from at least one of the same sources that our team got in the investigation of Butler. Okay. So let's go to cut one here in the show notes. UVU AI debunked. This is an example of what you saw, kind of the knowledge-based training video that you saw and now hopefully understand better, or if you already understood that, it brings it to the top of your mind. But here's cut one.
All right, so when they first released the surveillance footage of Tyler Robinson jumping off of the roof, there was a lot of people out there saying that was AI footage because the people in the background or a person in the background disappeared suddenly behind a tree. And it looks like that path is just going from right to left. That person gets up to that tree. It looks like he should just keep going forward, but then suddenly he disappears. And of course, there was this whole thing started saying that it was AI. I definitely thought the whole thing was weird. And that was one of the things I wanted to investigate while I was there at UVU.
All right, folks. So one of the things that keeps coming up time and time again is the quote unquote AI footage that we see, that camera on that corner right there. And what I want you to notice in that original video, you only see three trees. There's actually four trees here, but the reason we only see three in that footage, the camera is perfectly lined up. These two trees are lined up, so we only see three trees total. And then I have an assistant over here. We got Eric. He is walking. What you don't realize is two things take place. Number one is that path actually curves, but then it drops off. And so, again, when you're looking at this,
that camera can film all the way to,
he disappears completely as he continues to go down. That path basically not only drops off, but stays in line with these trees. And of course, this footage is much clearer than that camera footage up there. As he comes back, he's coming up that path. You can't see him, and then now we see him. All right, just so that everybody has a closer view of what's going on here with this actual path and embankment, you can see right here, it goes sharply to the right. And you can see, I'm going to show this from the rear point. You follow that tree as you go down this path. So AI footage debunked.
So that was just one of several things that Gary Melton addressed. Okay. The reason I bring this up is because I believe that everyone who is interested in finding the truth about this, who wants to do the investigation themselves, I think they should do it, but also understand, again, the limitations and also the influence or lack thereof of AI. We have to keep that, you know, in focus, or at least understand the possibilities or the there's nothing like visiting a site yourself and seeing it yourself. I mean, you can look at pictures, you can look at video, but as Eric the Tech and myself, and as we have all experienced, you're not going to get the truth unless you yourself visit that site as close to the event that took place as possible. Now, again, there's so many elements we just can't cover everything, obviously, but that was one issue that I think was of extreme importance. Now, Gary Melton's got just a ton of videos, about this topic, about the bigger issue, where he takes questions, provides his insight. And, again, he's offering now in his visit. And I can't imagine how much the drone mapping of this area costs, but I will say this, he's making that available to everyone who wants it. So that's the way it should be. I have to say that's the way it should be. And his, again, his account is Paramount Tactical, and you can find the link at HagmanPI.com. So I hope that gives some, you know, I don't expect to get likes or clicks from this video, from this episode, or from this show. I just don't, because it's not popular. The topic itself is not glamorous. It's not like, hey, we found the answers and here it is. And we'll show you there's multiple shooters. This is not that. Now, what we can say is, even based on our most basic investigation from the Discord and other meta conversation in other groups, that with a high degree of certainty that the alleged shooter, Tyler Robinson, was not the only one there. Was he the only shooter? At this point, I haven't seen evidence to the contrary. And I think Eric the Tech, I don't think I put this in the show notes. Let's see if we have time. We don't have time for this. But if you go down in this timeline, you may find, or you will find, a video that is in addition to that video you saw, where you see Robinson jumping off the roof with a towel and the what appears to be something like akin to a long gun. Okay, and there's analysis done of that video based on the resolution and based on all of the proper factors. Again, proper factors. So, this stuff is not glamorous. The investigation into these things, it's not glamorous, nor should it be. Okay. But it's a very exact, it's necessary. You've got to have it exact, and you've got to understand the limitations of video, photographs, two dimensions, and, or you have to have the, you have to go out and take a look for yourself, especially things like the angles and the possibilities. I'm just saying, it's less than glamorous, but some people want it to be and paint it out to be for what? For the clicks, notoriety, viral videos, and for reasons that really, to me, shouldn't be present in this kind of investigation. There it is. Folks, I really hope that all of this made sense tonight for you, that there was at least that we covered enough to show you that, yes, there are anomalies out there that need to be investigated, that, yes, we're seeing justice, some justice, at least at the indictment level. What happens after that, we don't know, of criminal actors, people involved in treason and sedition. We're seeing some movement there, which is encouraging. So there's that. We're identifying the groups responsible for this. And lastly, I think we do have time for this. Remember when we came out, remember on Tuesday's show, that executive order I spoke about from September by President Trump. Hey, there's some, Antifa is a domestic terrorist organization. That designation, that is going to hurt. All right. I have in the show notes, and let me see here, Eric the Tech, if you can pop in real quick. Let me just get this right. I know we're getting to the end. Just hold on. Okay. Video 9. We'll close that with this. Trump administration tells banks to report domestic terror activity. This is absolutely one of the biggest deals out there, because now we know that this administration is serious about going after the funders of Antifa. You know, that idea? No, the group itself. And even if we run over a little bit, go ahead. Maybe we can truncate the video, but here's cut 9 real quick.
Yeah, Steve, thanks for having me again. What we reported at the Free Press yesterday is that the Treasury Department's Financial and Crimes Enforcement Network, also known as FinCEN, which is an office within the U.S. Treasury Department